That you both are experienced appellate lawyers. You'll each have 15 minutes with 5 minutes of rebuttal. For appellant, state your names at the beginning of the hearing and the client that you're representing. And if at any point you can't hear us, wave your arms or something. We want to make sure that it's as similar to in person as possible. So with that, Mr. Marshall, would you please call the case?
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Flory, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. Calling the case of A20-0470, State of Minnesota versus Willie Ware.
Thank you. And Mr. Mishick, are you ready to proceed?
I am now, Your Honor.
Thank you. It helps if you unmute.
It does. May it please the court, my name is Christopher Mishick. I represent appellant Willie Ware. Willie Ware pleaded guilty to a second degree criminal sexual conduct charge and was convicted and sent to prison. Mr. Ware is now seeking to withdraw his plea. The issue I want to focus on today is the second issue of my brief about whether or not Mr. Ware's trial counsel had a conflict of interest. And if there's time after that, I'd like to get to the third issue about the sentencing. This case really should be remanded back to the district court at the very least, so that Mr. Ware can re-argue his plea withdrawal motion with an attorney that did not have a conflict of interest.
So let me, if you could just clarify for me, Mr. Mishick, because it's not completely clear to me exactly what, even if we assume there was a conflict, what was the ineffective representation that you're arguing here? Was it the failure to argue the motion that the court allowed to go forward? The failure to file a motion? What is the specific claim that was ineffective?
Yeah, what was ineffective was the fact that he never argued his client's motion. He never put, you know, forth an argument about why the plea was invalid when the client wanted the motion to be brought.
Would he have said that the client wasn't allowed to say?
Well, he could have talked about a number of things. So there were issues with the client's mental health, his mental illness. He could have gotten into the record some evidence about what was going on at the time of the plea as far as him taking.
With regard to the mental health issue, in August, he argued that his client's mind was clearer than it had ever been because he now was on an antipsychotic or psychotropic drug. And so therefore his client should be released. And so doesn't that cut against that, your client saying at the time of the plea that his mind was impaired by Seroquel?
I agree that it cuts against it and it's a bad fact for us. However, this sort of gets to the heart of it. I mean, he didn't have an attorney then to fully argue this and to say, well, okay, back then we thought the Seroquel was working and he was of sound mind, but here's actually what was happening. And then to go into actually the effects of Seroquel and maybe get him a psychological examination to talk about what was going on or to put forth some sort of motion like that. He didn't have that at the hearing, and that was the problem. So just to go into the two tests here, if there is no objection at the district court level and the district court isn't aware of what's going on, then the test is, was there a conflict of interest? Was there an active conflict? And did that conflict hurt the representation? The second test is if the court was aware and didn't do an inquiry. I think that Mr. Ware wins on both of these tests. However, I think the second test is more applicable here. Mr.
How is it more applicable? I guess my question for you, Mr. Mishick, is at the plea hearing, your client testified under oath that there was no duress or coercion on behalf of anyone when he entered the plea. And it wasn't until after he had talked to the psychosexual evaluator that he then writes a letter to the court alleging basically duress or coercion based on the conflict here. So it would almost seem to me that if we were to accept, two things seem, and you can address them. Mm-hmm. One is if we accept this argument, then really no plea is ever really significant at the time it's entered, because these types of claims can always be raised after the fact. And if simply raising a claim is enough to call the plea into question, I think that raises some issues as to whether, you know, there really is much significance to the actual time that the plea is entered. Secondly, to accept your position here is almost an admission that your client committed perjury at the time he entered his plea, which is also really troubling to me. So how do we sort that out? And if we accept your position that it's really the latter of the two circumstances, that the court was on notice despite the previous testimony under oath?
Thanks for the question. I'll push back a little on the plea itself. You know, if you look at the plea transcript, it was Mr. Ware said four words. He said, yeah, yes, no, and guilty. There was not a really kind of in-depth analysis or questioning of him of his mental state at the time. He wasn't, the only question he was asked is, was his mind clear? And so the way I think the court was on notice, however, more so, was the court got a letter from him discussing issues he was having with his attorney about billing and the problems he was having. He accused his attorney of being ineffective. And that sort of those sort of accusations are exactly what happened in State v. Page that I cited in my brief. You know, it's the same kind of fact scenario where someone's accusing their attorney of being ineffective and not doing the job. So here, I do think the court then, once the court got the letter and read it, was on notice that here there's possible conflict here where the attorney wouldn't be able to argue certain things, especially an ineffective claim.
Well, that's not exactly an entirely fair representation of what happened, counsel, because the letter that your client sent to the court alleged a conflict of interest arising out of the compensation of the attorney. And then, to her credit, the district court judge inquired of your client at the sentencing hearing about the conflict. And then the reason for the plea withdrawal morphed into, my mind wasn't clear. So there were different reasons. And the ultimate reason that was proffered to the district court judge in person was, my mind's not clear.
Well, I disagree with that characterization somewhat, in the sense that he was asked by the judge, you know, what's the basis for your motion? He started to talk about what was in the letter, and then the judge shut him down and said, I've read the letter, you don't need to talk about it. And then he shifted to the Seroquel. So I don't think he said, well, I'm not talking, you know, I'm not raising this stuff about the billing anymore. I think he was just told, I read the letter, I don't need to hear this again. So I disagree with that. I'm sorry, was there a second part of your question?
No, go ahead, counsel.
And I want to address what Judge Flory talked about with perjury. I mean, that would have to be dealt with later, obviously, if he was charged with that. He, you know, claims that his mind wasn't sound. So I think that perjury has to be a knowingly, a knowing statement. And if that's the issue and it turns out that his mind wasn't sound or that's what he's claiming, there would be an issue then with successfully prosecuting a perjury charge. To go back to the test, so there was no objection. I do think the court should have known that it had reason to know there was a conflict here. The court did not make a proper inquiry about the conflict. The court didn't ask Mr. Brawlick if he was comfortable moving forward with his representation as far as making the motion. And none of those discussions were had. And really, because there was no inquiry about the conflict, this has to be reversed under the second test. And again, I'd point the court back to Page, where the facts here are very similar. In Page, the only thing different than Page was the attorney actively set on the actively defended. I think defended the plea coming in on the record. So kind of actively went against his client on the record. We shouldn't expect Mr. Brawlick to do that here and start to defend himself and to defend his reputation or his billing practices. That shouldn't be the standard here, and it isn't. It's whether or not counsel's lips were effectively sealed at that point. And counsel's lips were sealed. He couldn't talk about, you know, his billing practices, that's attorney-client privilege. There would have to be a separate attorney coming in to...
Well, why not? I mean, why couldn't he? He could tell him what he's charging. That's not privileged.
Well, I think it is privileged in the sense if they would get into conversations between him and Mr. Ware about conversations they had about billing and about trial and how much it'd be for trial. I think that would get into some sort of client communication where the attorney where Mr. Ware would have to waive his privilege. And again, to do that, he would have to have a new attorney to do that. Mr. Brawlick isn't in the position to waive his client's privilege to defend himself. I think that's the problem here. So I think under these facts, this fits in with Page. It also fits in with State v. Walker, which is an unpublished case. And Mr. Ware should be allowed to, again, go back to the district court and re-argue this motion with counsel, with a new counsel. Are there any questions on the second issue? I might move on to the third issue if there aren't any.
I don't see any questions. Why don't you move on to the sentencing?
Okay. So Mr. Ware also should be resentenced. Minnesota is in a minority of districts of states that say a defendant needs to be present and cannot waive his right to be sentenced, waive his right to be present at sentencing.
If we agree with you on that, I'm having a hard time seeing the prejudice or the error in that because he got what he bargained for and he expected to get pursuant to the plea agreement.
He did get what he bargained for. I agree. The prejudice is first of all, there's no harmless error analysis here that I saw in the case law. Shetsky is very clear that the old Supreme Court case that if a defendant is not present, that renders what happened void and illegal. And there's no analysis about, well, he knew he was going to get sentenced this way, so it's really kind of no harm, no foul. That's not the analysis. The analysis is that really this sentence is void as if it didn't happen. And so I don't think the court should get into a harm analysis in that sense.
So you want us to remand for the district court to impose the identical sentence with him present?
Yes, I do. And that's what happened in Shetsky. In Shetsky, he was, I think, at Stillwater, and they remanded it back to the district court to impose the sentence. Mr. Ware was taken out of the courtroom. And again, I mean, he could probably presume that he got the 94 months that was dealt with, but a judgment was not rendered in front of him. He was not told, you're going, I'm now sentencing you to prison. He was brought back to the holding cell, and then presumably he was sent to prison without that judgment being rendered in front of him. So I think that does warrant this to be remanded as well on that issue and to have him resentenced. If there aren't any questions, I'm going to stop here.
I don't see any questions, so thank you.
Thanks.
Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the state, or excuse me, may it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, my name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I would, for the most part, rely on my brief, as I think that it addresses most of the arguments here, but I would point the court to some of the language in Page with regard to the second issue. On page 765 Northwest 2nd at 139 to 140, the Page court states, the defendant cannot demand to proceed pro se or with substitute counsel merely to effect a delay in trial or sentencing. And I think if the court looks at the record here, that's exactly what was happening. He was raising an argument to try to delay the sentencing and to try to undo what he had accepted and pled guilty to. And the judge in this case, which Judge Frisch noted, to her credit, she inquired regarding it. I don't think that it was an abuse of the discretion to reject the argument that he was raising, but she read the letter. She told him that she was aware of it, and she gave him ample opportunity to speak about it. And then when she denied his request, he reacted by assaulting his attorney, which, turning to the sentencing, it is important to note that this would be the exact same sentence. So it is hard to see the prejudice or the harm here. This is very similar to the case in State versus Lehman, which unfortunately I believe Judge Flory was very familiar with. And this is something where the defendant in Lehman actually physically assaulted his attorney in front of the jury. And the Minnesota Court of Appeals said that it was still fine to shackle him and to continue on without the presence of a lawyer. Here, the right was forfeited when the defendant assaulted his attorney. He shouldn't be rewarded and given a continuance. I'm sorry, Judge Fish.
But isn't the assault of counsel a forfeiture of his right to counsel, not his right to be present for sentencing? I don't see anything in our case law or the rules that allows the district court to absent a defendant in sentencing per the request of your office.
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. It is a forfeiture of the right to counsel, and the rule does not explicitly state that it's a forfeiture of the right to be there. Appellant's counsel is correct that Minnesota is in the minority, and that for the most part, the rule says that an individual has a right to be present throughout every stage of the trial, including at sentencing. And if you look at the rule, it states that the trial may proceed to verdict without defendant if the defendant is absent based without justification or due to his or her conduct justifying expulsion. So the rule does not explicitly mention sentencing as the ability for the defendant to not be there, but the rule is based on the federal rule, Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 43, paren C, paren 2, specifically says that a defendant can be excluded from sentencing based on conduct.
Right. And the fact that our rule does not provide for absenting a defendant for sentencing is telling.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So, Ms. Lawan, Mr. Mishick tells us that a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt analysis isn't supported by the law. Even if we were to think that the court erred by excluding appellant from sentencing, do you agree with that analysis?
I disagree that there is no law supporting a harmlessness analysis. I think Lehman actually states that it can be harmless if, in fact, the defendant is not entitled to relief because the error is harmless. Here, as Judge Riley pointed out, it is a 94-month sentence. Nothing changes. I think worst case scenario, if it were to go back to the district court and they would impose the exact same sentence, that's fine. That would correct the error. However, this is not an error that's prejudicial. I do think that this court could clarify what is expected in such a circumstance. Perhaps it should have been calendared the following day and he should have come back the next day to be resentenced. But I think here, this isn't something where that absolutely needed to take place given the certainty of what the sentence would be. But I don't think it's prejudicial here. Unless there are further questions with regard to any of the issues, I would rely on the arguments made in my brief and respectfully ask that this court affirm the district court and affirm the sentence and conviction. Thank you.
I have a question about the letter that Mr. Ware sent to the judge, where he said that his attorney attempted to change the agreement by telling me he wanted more money and mm-hmm. And so he felt coerced. He wasn't going to be prepared. How is that not a conflict?
Your Honor, I think that based on that letter, the district court properly inquired regarding it and asked about it. And then as it's not a conflict per se, because it's a billing dispute, which possibly happens. His statement goes directly in contrast to the solemn declaration he made in open court, where he said no one was forcing him. No one was coercing him. He also stated that in the plea petition, I believe it's paragraphs 7 through, I might be wrong in the paragraphs, but in the plea petition, he states that this has not been made under duress, that he's not pleading guilty because anyone has forced him to do so, and that he's not asserting his innocence. He also stated that on pages, I believe, 7 through 9 of the plea transcript, saying that he's doing it of his own volition. No one has promised him anything. No one is coercing him. No one has threatened him. If he was not pleading guilty of his own volition, he should have said no to those questions. If he was pleading guilty because he didn't want to pay more money, the answer would have been no to those questions. So here, I think that the comments that he made in open court refute what he said. I think it's also important to look at the case law that talks at length about how, if you look, I believe the case is Butala versus State. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case from 2003 at 664 Northwest 2nd 333, where the attorneys don't speak on the defendant's behalf when there's an alleged conflict of interest. But if you look at the record as a whole, the Minnesota Supreme Court said, well, in fact, the record refutes their argument.
And then I just have, this is not on the record. I'm curious, in this COVID time, if we were to send it back for resentencing, would he just zoom in from whatever prison he's in, if you know?
Well, I think Hennepin is doing remote appearances right now. I actually have a sentencing tomorrow with someone who's zooming in from the jail, because they're not bringing them physically over for, he's being sentenced from the jail. So he's doing, it would be from remote appearance. I have also made appearances where someone has been sentenced remotely from prison. So I think there is an abundance of caution in not bringing the parties into the courtroom. All of us were outside the courtroom, including the judge, everyone. So that is possible. I can't say for certain. I do know that Judge Holton Dimmick has held some remote appearances as well. So, and I imagine that this would go back before her.
So I have one other question, and this has nothing necessarily to do with the arguments here. It's more of a procedural question. This case was charged out with the appellant's name being Willie the Third, where the notice of appeal continued that on, Willie the Third, where ultimately we're going to issue a decision here. Is everybody in agreement that his name is Willie the Third, where, or is it Willie the Where Third, and should we correct it? It's just, I know it's an odd question, but nobody seems to be addressing it, and it doesn't seem to make sense to me.
That's fair. And I actually am not sure. I know the prosecutor is actually watching this, so I can send her a message and ask. And I believe Mr. Mishek might actually have the ability to know that, as he's spoken to his client. So unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that.
Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Mishek?
Thanks. Am I on rebuttal now? Okay. First of all, addressing the name, I think it is Willie Ware the Third. I'm almost positive. I'll send a letter to the court if it is not Willie Ware the Third. I'd like to address a number of things. So, counsel for the state cited Page and talked about delay, and that would, you know, weaken a case if this was, or kill a case if it was slowly. If it was solely being done for delay. And I don't think that's the case here. I don't think Mr. Ware was just delaying things. He
did
wanted
the district
a trial.
Court make a finding on delay?
Your Honor,
I mean, I didn't see it.
I don't think so. I think the district court's finding was on timeliness. The court did find it untimely. And so either way, I think the motion was timely. It was, the letter was written 1 month after the plea hearing, and there's an issue with him if he is, you know, assuming what he says is true, that he's not that he's having problems with Seroquel and not of sound mind. That's not unreasonable for someone to sort of a few weeks later, after the medication wears off, or if gets used to it or changes it, realize that they're under the influence. The state also cites Butala in support of their argument. The thing in Butala, though, is that Butala had a post-conviction hearing with a separate counsel, and that was fully litigated before a post-conviction court the issue. So even though the trial counsel stepped aside and let the client kind of argue the motion, Butala later had a chance to litigate the issue. And the Supreme Court in Butala said that the better practice here really is to allow new counsel to step in, and that didn't happen here. The final thing I want to address is the state talked about a case with the sentencing issue, and I think it's Lehman or Ware. It starts with a W. I'm sorry, I can't remember it. Those cases, though, all go towards when a defendant forfeits or waives the right to be present during trial, and the analysis is different there because if someone's violent during trial, the analysis is they can't they forfeit the right to be present because they can't stop justice from happening. They can't stop the verdict from the case from getting to the verdict stage, and here the court in Shetsky separated those two things out and said, you know, this is about trial. Yes, you can waive it, you can forfeit it during trial, but if you're at the sentencing stage, the analysis is different. So I think those cases are distinguishable. If there aren't any other questions, I ask this court to remand Mr. Ware's case back to the district court so he can get separate counsel and re-argue his plea withdrawal motion.
Thank you. I don't see that there are any other questions. The case was well briefed and well argued, and we will have our decision out within the 90 days.